books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host Robert Kirkwood, and coming up today, we'll be chatting to Mari Hanna about her brand new DCI Kate Daniels book, The Longest Goodbye. We'll also find some new books in the RNIB Talking Books library, one written and narrated by Cliff Richard, and another that goes behind the scenes of Welcome to Wrexham. All that and much more on today's Read On. Multi-award winner Mari Hanna is the author of the Stone and Oliver crime series, the Ryan and O'Neill series, and the DCI Kate Daniels series. The Longest Goodbye is the ninth DCI Kate Daniels volume, and we'll discover later that it's a book she didn't want to write. 3 years ago, a police officer was murdered, her killers never brought to justice. Now the prime suspects have been shot dead within hours of their return to the UK. Has someone finally taken the law into their own hands? The audio version of The Longest Goodbye is read by Colleen Pendergast.
She knew instantly that a major operation was in full swing. A manhunt, he called it. Pulsar, a firearms team, dog section, the works. Finally, he managed to get the news out. Officer down, Gov. Shot in the back. Kate felt sick. An injury to any colleague, on or off duty, was a tragedy. This one was as serious as they came, potentially life-changing. Kate's stomach took a dive, convinced that he was about to tell her that the officer concerned was one of hers, before he told her that it wasn't. The duty senior investigating officer had been called out. So why was Pete calling if she wasn't required?
It's Georgina, boss. I'm so sorry.
He was sorry? What the hell did that mean? Sorry was something you said if you bumped into a stranger, accidentally knocking them sideways. Sorry was a word people used when they had been unkind to a loved one and wanted to make nice. Sorry was an overused coverall for bad behaviour, a throwaway comment that followed a minor mistake, a meaningless sentiment. Why was he sorry? He hadn't pulled the trigger. Paralysed by his words, Kate's mind raced through all the possible outcomes, none of them good. Georgina had to live. She had to. That improbable hope died in her heart as the controller spoke again.
She didn't make it, boss.
A clip of Colleen Prendergast reading from the latest DCI Kate Daniels adventure from Mari Hanna, The Longest Goodbye. And I'm delighted to see Mari joins me now. It's your first time on Read On, so let's go back to basics first of all and tell us about DCI Kate Daniels.
I first published, my debut was a Kate Daniels book, and I first published that in 2012. Kate is a very determined, tenacious murder detective who is loosely based on my partner, who was then a murder detective. She is a gay woman who hides her sexuality at the beginning of this series. And as we move through, we find out why. She doesn't want to be different. She is concerned that she won't reach the very top if she's honest about who she really is. It's been a fantastic series. I've really enjoyed writing it. And she's got quite a backstory to go away. So if anybody does join the series later, they usually go back to the beginning and read right through, which is fantastic. And my narrator is fantastic too. She's really got Kate. You know, she's able to sort of bring Kate to life in the audiobooks, and I really like that.
Death is something we all face. It was a constant in Kate's life, but Pete's words took her breath away. Ceasing to exist was final. the end of the line, no going back. That's it, end of. There was nothing else. Racing to the scene with coordinates for Rothbury Riverside, she called for an update. There was none. 45 minutes later, in an area flooded with police activity, she pulled up sharp, got out of her vehicle and climbed into full forensic kit. Terrified of what came next, she sucked in a breath, wiped her face with her hands, then slammed the tailgate of her Audi shut. All eyes turned towards her. A uniformed officer pointed her in the right direction. With a sense of urgency, she moved towards the River Coquette. Woods fringed the water's edge, a pretty path she'd walked a million times with Georgina, though never for exercise. They got enough of that at work. Now she was running along the dirt track. It was then she saw it. If not the crime scene, a deposition site. A white crime scene tent erected to keep prying eyes at bay, hers included. Lifting the tape surrounding the inner cordon, she was immediately confronted with a problem. The SIO, DCI Gordon Curtis, tried to block her way. "What are you doing here?" "Minding my own business. Get the hell out of my crime scene." Ignoring his request, Kate stepped aside. He grabbed her arm. She glanced at his hand, then at him, a hostile expression. She shrugged herself free. He didn't try to stop her.
The Longest Goodbye is a book that I didn't really ever want to write, because obviously if you've been partner to a police officer, then you don't ever want to get the knock on the door that says they're never coming home. But I think over the years, there have been quite a lot of police officers who died on and off duty. Two are buried not that far away from where I live. And I just thought now was the time I would tackle that. And so The Longest Goodbye concerns a female police officer. The book opens with a couple of young men in a car coming home from abroad, coming home for Christmas on Christmas Eve. In that first chapter, they are murdered on their doorstep. And it comes to light that they, in fact, were the suspects of a previous murder that happened 3 years earlier. And that's the murder of police officer Georgina Iannou, who was murdered and her killers were never brought to justice because these two skipped the country and went off and have not been seen until this day. So that's the kind of story that we're talking about. Georgina is a very big friend of Kate. She was not involved in her murder 3 years before, but as Kate does occasionally, she kind of can't help herself and she barges into this one. And so the cases that they deal with in The Longest Goodbye are split. Hank Gormley is Kate's second in command, and he takes charge of the shooting of these two young men, who, even though they were the chief suspects, we still have to prove that actually they were the ones who murdered Georgina. And Kate herself takes on Georgina's murder because the SIO who was in charge of that case has since retired. So we've got two stories running alongside each other, very linked to each other. I found it quite fascinating to write, and I hope your listeners will feel that when they have a listen in and go to the very end.
Yeah, it keeps you guessing, this one, but I believe that experience of the Northumbrian police officer being murdered on duty was one that was very close to you at the time.
Yes, years and years before, I was just at home and I heard on the news that a policewoman had been shot in the back. My partner was out at work at the time. It was a horrible, shocking thing to happen. And I phoned her office and was told that she was out. And, you know, part of me was thinking that this is this was them closing ranks, not telling me what I wanted to know. Where, you know, is she okay? Was she okay? Her name is Maureen. The woman who was shot in the back did live. Her name was also Maureen. And so it kind of, well, it was very, very close to home. Yeah, I think I always knew I would write that, but I think I've kind of waited on the sidelines until I felt comfortable enough to deal with that. It was heartbreaking. And it lived with me for quite a long time before I could deal with it.
And you yourself were involved in law enforcement as a probation officer. What prompted the move from that career to writing?
Well, it wasn't my choice. I went to work one day and I was assaulted at work quite badly. I had a wrist injury that needed required surgery, and that took a very long time to get over because it was quite complicated, as wrists are. And so I was let go on a medical pension and thought, what on earth am I going to do now? I'm far too young to retire. And the thing that I knew most about, obviously, was, you know, that of my 15 years experience in the probation service. So I knew courts, I knew police, I knew prisons. I'd worked in a prison for 3 years. And the other thing is that I absolutely loved reading crime novels. And crime fiction is my reading go-to on a rainy day. And I felt that I had something that I could transfer easily. Of course, I knew nothing about how to write a novel, only how to read one. And it took a very long time to sort of polish my skills enough to show my book to anyone. But yeah, so I knew the world. So I don't have to go very far from my home to do my research, because obviously my partner was in the police, although we do have to make sure that we keep up to, you know, date with what's going on in the police. But we also have friends who are currently serving officers, so I can always go and ask them if I need to.
She approached the tent, her heart kicking a hole in her ribcage by the time she reached it. She stood there, adrenaline pumping, a cold sweat forming on her brow. She was in danger here, professionally, not physically. Protocol dictated that she turn around and return to base. She couldn't do it. She wouldn't. Some things were more important than regulations. Pure desperation was driving her to see for herself that those who'd found the body were not guilty of mistaken identity. Wanting it to be true didn't make it so. An officer had been murdered. If not Georgina, then another colleague whose family would suffer. The last few steps felt like a mile. And still, Kate clung to the hope that an error had been made. Opening the flap of the tent, she stepped inside, in no doubt that she was breaking every rule. She was past caring. Even though she knew what to expect, it was a shock to view the body of a much-loved colleague lying face down on the ground, arms splayed out, a dark patch of blood across her back. Kate knew instantly that it was Georgina. She'd entered the wood, alone and unprotected, with no police-issue radio on which to call for help, a sitting duck for anyone who'd do her harm.
As we said, this is DCI Kate Daniels' ninth book, and as Stephen King has constant readers, you've got your constant narrator. Has Colleen sort of become DCI Kate Daniels in your head?
Colleen and I had never met before about a month and a half ago. My publisher, Orion, asked me if I would like to go down to London and do a little interview with her that would actually also be included in the audiobook. So your listeners will definitely be able to listen to that. And we'd not met before, although we had corresponded over email and over text on various things, because she's very good at, did you mean this? You know, do you want the emphasis on this piece or that piece? How is this, how does this name sound? Is it like this or is it like this? And she's very, very professional. And I said to her in that interview, I actually feel I wanted to be a police officer, but my children were too young. And so I'm kind of living my cop life, if you like, through the books. So I always feel as if it's me who's Kate Daniels rather than anyone else. But she pulls her off marvellously, I have to say.
The pathologist, Sue Morrissey, was on her knees in the middle of her examination, recording her initial impressions that the SIO should have been there to witness. Pausing the audio device, she glanced over her shoulder, her blue eyes managing to convey sorrow and compassion non-verbally through the narrow slit between cap and mask. She looked at the body, then at Kate, an expression the detective chief inspector interpreted as confusion over who would oversee the investigation. "Are you taking over, Kate?"
"No, I had to come."
Morrissey's nod was almost imperceptible. "I hate to ask, but would you mind helping me turn her over? Curtis stepped out. I don't know why."
"Well, it wouldn't be for police work, would it?"
Taking a pair of gloves from her pocket, Kate pulled them on.
"Ready?"
Sue said. Kate was not ready. How could she be? This was Georgina, daughter to Molly, wife to Nico, mother to Charlotte and Oscar, all of whom she knew personally, a family whose lives were about to implode. For them and for Kate, life would never be the same.
Now, you've read parts of your book out at festivals, etc. Do you never think of narrating one yourself?
No, because I think we did talk about this during the interview. It's not something that I would ever really want to do. Colleen is so good at pulling off the accents, and you know, I mean, I've taken my characters to Spain, and I've taken them to Iceland, and all over the place, and I couldn't be those different people that she seems to be able to be. Of course, she's an actor, so she is, you know, used to using different voices. If I narrated the book, it would all be in my voice. And whilst that would work in some ways, I think that she brings so much more than I could bring to it, to that task. I think narrators are worth weight in gold, really, if you get the right one.
Colleen has not only read DCI Kate Daniels, she also reads the Stone and Oliver books, but was it strange hearing Tim Bruce read the Matthew Ryans?
Well, that was pre-Colleen, and I thought he was really good. But the Matthew Ryan books were only ever going to be one book. The Silent Room was written as a standalone, and it wasn't until the book went to the US and they liked it so much, they wanted me to write a second. So I did write a second. He was brilliant at the job.
Now, since we've mentioned this, The Silent Room, that is one of your books with a blind character. How was it writing that?
Well, I always think it's important that fiction reflects the real world that we live in, whatever people's difference. And there is a lady who lives very close to me, who I used to see on the station with her guide dog. She was amazing, independent, absolutely fabulous, and she fascinated me. And I just thought, do you know, I had never read a crime novel with a person who had no sight. And I just thought that I wanted to include someone. And so I made Matthew Ryan's twin sister a blind from birth. It was a fascinating journey because she's a Crown prosecutor and she is a professional woman in her own right. But she is also someone who has skills that seeing people don't have. And I wanted to demonstrate that in the book, so that I give her quite a role in the book. She hears things that the detectives don't hear. And I found the research of that very fascinating.
Now, all the books are available in audio through all of your series. Is it important that your work is accessible to everyone, regardless of their relationship with print?
Absolutely. And to be honest, I absolutely adore listening to audiobooks of my favourite authors. Obviously, I travel around quite a lot and I love to listen to them in the car. You just, you know, the miles just go away, don't they? You know, and I think you, as long as the narrator's voice is one that you like, and I think that's really important. Can I live with this voice for 15 hours? And I think, you know, there has been a time when all nine, including the one that hasn't come out yet, Kate Daniels books have been in the top 20 audiobooks, and that just pleases me no end because I want everyone to be able to access my books in whichever way they can.
And possibly soon they'll be able to access Kate Daniels on TV.
Mm, I can't wait. Yes, she's in development with Sprout Pictures and Atlantic Nomad, who are a production company in the US, and they're working together on it. It's taken quite a while to come to this point where we think we've chosen the right screenwriter. But yeah, we're heading that way, and I'm really, really looking forward to it. It's a dream for me to see my characters realised on screen.
You're a screenwriter yourself. Do you not fancy doing the adaptation?
Well, I did throw my hat in the ring, to be honest, but I haven't got the experience that I think is required to take myself out of this series. I think I'm too close to the material. If I was writing something brand new, I think I probably would fare better. And I certainly, I have been screenwriting lately. And in fact, I've just put Matthew Ryan's The Silent Room in as a sort of action thriller to a company who's been asking female writers who are unrepresented, really, in screenwriting world. There are some, but often it's the guys who seem to get, you know, the jobs. And I thought that was brilliant, so I put that in. So, yes, I am screenwriting, but I think for the Kate Daniels series, I think it's good to have someone who brings something different to the series, because they can't just be a rewrite of the book. They have to be different from the book, although they will be largely based on the books, and I don't know in what order they're going to come out yet.
On autopilot, her eyes scanned the scene to see what it would tell her, drifting to a point 2 yards from Georgina's body, to something that did not belong to her. Kate imagined a female inspector, shocked and out of breath, crouching down, checking for signs of life, instinctively removing her hat before doing so, forgetting to collect it when the doc arrived. The hat lay upturned on the ground, the cap badge upside down, symbolising a fallen colleague. It was the small things that got to you.
The Longest Goodbye by Mari Hanna, book 9 in the DCI Kate Daniels series, is out now in print as an ebook and in audio as read by Colleen Prendergast. And many books by Mari Hanna are also available in the RNIB Talking Books Library. And Mari, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Been a pleasure.
And Mari will be back at the end of the show with the books of her life. Now let's hear about the music that inspired Cliff Richard as we find some new gems in the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. For those who enjoy family stories, Orion have donated The Sunrise Sisterhood by Kathy Bramley.
I checked the front pocket of my rucksack for my passport. It was there, just as it had been the last 5 times I'd looked. The taxi I'd booked to take me to the airport on the other side of Kampala was due any minute. My throat was tight with the anxiety which had been building over the last 48 hours. Was I doing the right thing? I thought I was, but it didn't stop the niggling voice in my head telling me I was running away. Back to the place I'd run from. I'd initially come to Africa to travel, to do some volunteering, to escape from a life that had felt pointless, and from my parents, specifically my father, who made me feel as if nothing I did was ever good enough. Within days of arriving here at the Hope Foundation charity project in Uganda, I felt sure I'd found the place I was supposed to be. Here I felt valued. I had a role to play, and for the first time, my life had purpose.
The holidays are here, and in Salcombe, Liz longs for the arrival of her goddaughters, Skye and Claire, and Claire's daughter, baby Ivy. After years on her own, she needs help to save the catering business she built with Claire's late mother, Jen. However, half-sisters Skye and Claire couldn't be more different, struggling with family secrets and hidden jealousies. As the women navigate this unexpected summer together, truths are revealed and the relationships are put to the test.
Before long, the emotional baggage I'd brought with me became irrelevant in a country where life felt raw and vivid, bigger than anything I'd experienced. The red dirt roads, chaotic traffic, and crowded towns were islands in a vast ocean of green plains, inhabited by animals I'd only seen in zoos. Scorching dry heat was counterbalanced by torrential rain, and despite the poverty, I'd encountered friendship, community, and pure happiness. Uganda was a country of contrasts, and for a young woman who wasn't quite sure who she wanted to be, it was the perfect place to be while she figured it out. 5 years on, and apparently I still hadn't figured it out. My case was sitting in the doorway, stuffed with as many mementos from my time here as I could fit in it. Even so, I was leaving a lot behind. I cast one last look around the house and walked outside onto the porch, where I could avoid seeing all Jessie's pairs of flip-flops piled up by the door, and the knick-knacks we'd accumulated over the years to make this tin-roofed house feel like a home. The wood carvings, wall hangings, and the children's art I'd been given and couldn't bring myself to throw out. I kept my eyes on the entrance to the camp, willing the taxi to hurry up. My palms were clammy and my stomach was fluttery with nerves. My plans to return home to the UK had been made so quickly that I kept expecting to wake up and find it was a dream. That what had happened at the party 2 nights ago wasn't real, and that any minute now everything would be back to normal. But then I'd catch Jessie's eye, and my stomach would plummet all over again. My carefully curated, simple life, managing the volunteers who came here to work at the Hope Foundation, was over.
The Sunrise Sisterhood by Kathy Bramley is read by Leslie Sharp and runs for 11 hours, 21 minutes.
Next, Cliff Richard takes us on a musical tour through his life in A Head Full of Music, which was gifted to us by Penguin Random House.
Before Elvis shoved rock and roll to the very centre of my life, music was really just background noise for me. Pleasant, diverting, and inconsequential. An occasional tune might catch my fancy, but nothing about the ditties that I was hearing on the radio sounded remotely important or life-changing. As I explained in my life story, The Dreamer, my first musical memory as a boy growing up in India was being put in my church school's choir. I can't remember which hymns we sang, just how mortified I felt at having to wear a cassock, which to me felt like putting on a girl's dress. We had music at home. My dad worked for a catering company, but he was also a hobby musician, playing banjo in his firm's jazz band. In our apartment, we had a gramophone, which had what looked like a huge old hearing aid sticking out of it, an ancient wooden contraption that played my parents' records. My mum and dad would listen to singers such as Frank Sinatra, Ella Fitzgerald on there, as well as big bands like Stan Kenton and his orchestra. And when I was only 4 years old, I had my own little party piece.
On a sunny Saturday morning in May 1956, a 15-year-old, then called Harry Webb, was mooching down Waltham Cross High Street with two mates. They heard some music blaring out of a parked car. It stopped them in their tracks. The song was Heartbreak Hotel by Elvis Presley. It sounded like nothing they'd ever heard before. In that instant, the schoolboy who was destined to take the hit parade by storm as Cliff Richard fell in love with rock and roll. It gave him the thrill, the purpose, and the mission that has shaped his life ever since. Cliff lives in and for music, and with 65 years as a hitmaker, the music filling his head is a broad category. His soundtrack begins by blasting us all back into that first explosion of rock and roll, as it redefined youth culture and changed so many lives, including Cliff's own, and also includes great soul stars such as Aretha Franklin, longtime colleagues like Elton John, his all-time favourite band, the Bee Gees, amazing gospel artists, and much-missed close friends, Zilla Black and Olivia Newton-John. This book is meaningful to Cliff on a number of levels. The 30 or so songs here that make up the soundtrack to his life have each moved him deeply, but it's also about the legendary artists he met and often got to know. He shares those stories and memories with you too.
Whenever my parents had friends over for dinner, Dad would tell me, "Harry, go and get Chewing a Piece of Straw." This was a 10-inch single by Jack Payne and his orchestra. I would scurry over to Mum and Dad's record collection, stacked neatly by the gramophone, fish it out, and proudly run back and hand it to them. I couldn't read yet, of course, but I could recognize the shape of the writing on the label in the middle of the record. Nearly 8 years on, I can still picture it, and still remember the guests all saying, "Look at that," as they praised me for being so clever. I liked that. That gramophone got sold and left behind when my family moved to England in 1948, after partition had divided British India into India and Pakistan. We lived in relatives' spare rooms for 2 years and were very poor. We didn't even have enough money for a radio, let alone a record player. My dad was nothing if not ingenious and brilliant with his hands. And when my parents, my three sisters and I were all living in one room at my Auntie Dorothy's house in Waltham Cross in 1950, he built us a crystal radio set. This was a basic radio receiver with valves and a big pair of headphones attached to it. We took it with us when we got given our own council house down the road in Cheshunt at the end of that year. I would sometimes sit in the front room and listen to it after school or at the weekends, but if I'm honest, I wasn't all that excited about the music I was hearing on the BBC Light programme. Before I got into music, my favourite show on the BBC Light programme was The Goons. My friends and I would all listen to it at home and then go to school and impersonate Neddy Seagoon, Eccles, Bluebottle.
A Head Full of Music, the soundtrack to my life by Cliff Richard, is narrated by Cliff Richard and Roy McMillan and runs for 9 hours 39 minutes. And Lynn will be back with two more books, including one that goes behind the scenes of the Disney Plus show Welcome to Wrexham, after this trip back in time to hear from one of RNIB's celebrity narrators. RNIB Talking Books have had the privilege of working with some great authors who have come into the studios to record their own work. Roald Dahl is known for tales such as The BFG, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Matilda, and James and the Giant Peach. And it was the latter of those stories that he came into the studios to record back in 1986, and also recorded this exclusive introduction.
James and the Giant Peach was the very first of the 15 or 16 children's books I have written. I wrote it in 1961 in America, some 26 years ago. And up to then, I'd spent a long time, about 15 years, writing only short stories for adults. But by then, I had a couple of children of my own, and I used to tell them stories in bed, and one day I told them one that they seemed to like and wanted more of, and it was about a peach. And so I thought, well, why don't I try to write a children's book about it? And so I did. The news that a peach almost as big as a house had suddenly appeared in someone's garden spread like wildfire across the countryside. And the next day a stream of people came scrambling up the hill to gaze upon this marvel. Quickly, Aunt Sponge and Aunt Spiker called in carpenters and had them build a strong fence around the peach to save it from the crowd. And at the same time, these two crafty women stationed themselves at the front gate with a large bunch of tickets and started charging everyone for coming up. "Roll up, roll up," Aunt Spiker yelled. "Only 1 shilling to see the Giant Peach." "Half price for children under 6 weeks old," Aunt Sponge shouted. "One at a time, please. Don't push, don't push. You're all going to get in." "Hey, you, come back there. You haven't paid." By lunchtime, the whole place was a seething mass of men, women, and children all pushing and shoving to get a glimpse of this miraculous fruit. Helicopters were landing like wasps all over the hill, and out of them poured swarms of newspaper reporters, cameramen, and men from the television companies. "It'll cost you double to bring in a camera," Aunt Spiker shouted. All right," they answered. "We don't care." And the money came rolling into the pockets of the two greedy aunts. But while all this excitement was going on outside, poor James was forced to stay locked in his bedroom, peeping through the bars of his window at the crowds below. "The disgusting little brute will only get in everyone's way if we let him wander about," Aunt Spiker had said early that morning. "Oh, please," he had begged. "I haven't met any other children for years and years, and there are going to be lots of them down there for me to play with. And perhaps I could help you with the tickets." "Cut it out," Aunt Sponge had snapped. "Your Aunt Spiker and I are about to become millionaires, and the last thing we want is the likes of you messing things up and getting in the way."
Roald Dahl reading from James and the Giant Peach in the RNIB Talking Book Studios back in 1986. For more information on the free Talking Book service, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
The Moth.
I'm Jay Ellison. Join us for more true personal stories told live on stage. No scripts, no notes, no nothing. Each Moth Radio Hour is a mix of funny and heartbreaking tales that captivate and surprise and delight audiences around the world with their honesty and bravery and humor. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
On RNIB Connect Radio.
Wednesdays at 8 p.m, Thursday at noon, and Sundays at 11 a.m.
The Moth on RNIB Connect Radio.
Here's a great sports story. Headline have gifted us with Tinseltown, Hollywood and the Beautiful Game, a match made in Wrexham by Ian Herbert.
The supporters fighting to keep Wrexham Football Club alive had done their best to introduce something vibrant and optimistic on the Mould Road approach to the racecourse ground. Some daffodils were delivering some colour in a small flowerbed they had created there in the early days of March 2020. They had been blooming on the 1st of March, Dydd Gwyl Dewi Sant, St David's Day, the occasion when Wales celebrates its nationhood each year. But the sky was slate grey a week later, and there was little spring in the steps of the groups of football supporters who trudged up to the stadium, their faces set against a bitter wind that whipped in from the Berwyn Mountains, to watch the team's match against Eastleigh in the fifth tier National League. Many wore replica tops that carried the Wrexham club crest, a signifier of the club's longevity and history, the year 1864 woven into it in black stitching. This was a permanent reminder that theirs was the third oldest association football club in the world. They walked past a green plaque set into the exterior wall of the Mould Road stand, marking a 1909 football international here. Though Wales played Scotland at the racecourse ground and lost 2-0, as far back as 1877.
Here is the remarkable inside story of how two Hollywood A-listers, Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds, stunned the football world by buying a non-league club in North Wales. It was one of the most extraordinary takeovers British football has known. In February 2021, Ryan Reynolds joined with Rob McElhenney to buy Wrexham AFC, a non-league team in North Wales. Wrexham, a former coal and steel town dealing with its post-industrial legacy, suddenly found itself at the centre of global attention, with broadcast networks around the world descending to discover what was going on. The club became the subject of a smash-hit Disney Plus docu-series, Welcome to Wrexham. Tinseltown tells the story of this extraordinary, unpredictable and often surreal football takeover, and the remarkable events that followed. Written with the full cooperation of Wrexham AFC, it is the inside story of what happened when Hollywood met a dot on a map, how a town was transformed when its football club, aspiring only to survive on the fifth rung of the British football ladder, was sprinkled with gold dust and found ambition again. with unique access to players, the manager and the club's executives, providing a vivid sense of what it is like to play for this Hollywood team and the pressure and the spotlight that comes with it. At their only press conference since buying the club, nobody laughed when Reynolds and McElhenney said that the Premier League could be an aspiration. "Couldn't we theoretically make this happen?" McElhenney said. "Why not dream big?" added Reynolds. "If you don't dream big, you will never go there, so why not?" Tinseltown is a story of how they did just that.
But the club, like the North Wales town, was struggling. And for the first time in over 150 years, the threat of relegation to the sixth tier stalked the place. That would remove Wrexham from national football and consign the club to a regional division. Fixed to one of the floodlights on the Mould Road side of the ground was the board with the words, "Next match, Wrexham v." The names of some mighty teams have been affixed up there. Arsenal, AS Roma, Anderlecht, Real Zaragoza, Porto. The sign was not used that day, and the thread to that colourful past was becoming thinner. In the 1980s and 1990s, the notion of even playing Eastleigh, a non-league team from a small market town in Hampshire, would have been risible. But on the 7th of March 2020, both teams were fighting to stave off relegation, which would befall the bottom four teams in the league. Wrexham were sixth from bottom as they went into that afternoon's match, a mere 2 points above the drop zone. Eastleigh were seventh from bottom after a midweek win over the league's weakest side, Chorley. Wrexham could not deny that they risked the drop. The team's midfielder, Luke Young, was put forward for media duties that week, describing how he had made that same descent to the sixth tier with Torquay United 2 years earlier, how desperate it had felt, and that a spirit of resolve was needed now.
Tinseltown, Hollywood and the Beautiful Game, A Match Made in Wrexham, by Ian Herbert, is narrated by Tom Lawrence, and lasts for 11 hours, 26 minutes.
We have the latest in the best-selling Cormoran Strike series, which you may have seen on TV. It's called The Running Grave by Robert Galbraith and was donated to us by Little Brown.
Private Detective Cormoran Strike was standing in the corner of a small, stuffy, crowded marquee with a wailing baby in his arms. Heavy rain was falling onto the canvas above, its irregular drumbeat audible even over the chatter of guests and his newly baptised godson's screams. The heater at Strike's back was pumping out too much warmth, but he couldn't move because three blonde women, all of whom were around 40 and holding plastic glasses of champagne, had him trapped while taking it in turns to shout questions about his most newsworthy cases. Strike had agreed to hold the baby for a mo, while the baby's mother went to the bathroom. But she'd been gone for what felt like an hour. "When," asked the tallest of the blondes loudly, "did you realise it wasn't suicide?" "Took a while," Strike shouted back, full of resentment that one of these women wasn't offering to hold the baby. Surely they knew some arcane female trick that would soothe him. He tried gently bouncing the child up and down in his arms. It shrieked still more bitterly.
Private Detective Cormoran Strike is contacted by a worried father whose son Will has gone to join a religious cult. The Universal Humanitarian Church is, on the surface, a peaceable organisation that campaigns for a better world. Yet Strike discovers that beneath the surface there are deeply sinister undertones and unexplained deaths. In order to try and rescue Will, Strike's business partner Robin Ellicott decides to infiltrate the cult. She travels to Norfolk to live incognito amongst them. Robin is unprepared for the dangers that await her there, or for the toll it will take on her.
Behind the blonde stood a brunette in a shocking pink dress, whose Strike had noticed back at the church. She talked and giggled loudly from her pew before the service had started, and had drawn a lot of attention to herself by saying, "Oh," loudly, while the holy water was being poured over the sleeping baby's head, so that half the congregation was looking at her rather than towards the font. Their eyes now met. Hers were a bright sea blue, and expertly made up so that they stood out like aquamarines against her olive skin and long dark brown hair. Strike broke eye contact first. Just as the lopsided fascinator and slow reactions of the proud grandmother told Strike she'd already drunk too much, so that glance had told him that the woman in pink was trouble. "And the Shacklewell Ripper," said the bespectacled blonde, "did you actually physically catch him?"
"No, I did it all telepathically."
"Sorry," said Strike, because he'd just glimpsed Ilsa, his godson's mother, through the French doors leading into the kitchen. "Need to give him back to his mum."
The Running Grave by Robert Galbraith is narrated by Robert Glenister and lasts for 34 hours and 14 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Murder Under the Sun, written by Agatha Christie.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Brazil by Michael Palin.
Every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. enjoy a classic from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Black Beauty by Anna Sewell.
Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte.
Plus, you can enjoy a book for the younger listener or young at heart every Saturday at 9 a.m. with a repeat on Sundays at 3 p.m. and Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
Alice's Adventures in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll.
Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery.
Enjoy your favourite talking books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.
And now a return to Mari Hanna, the author of The Longest Goodbye, for the books of her life. Now, Mari, was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
I loved Little Women. And I think I was fascinated by their daughters. It was the first time that I'd noticed differentness, and the whole thing fascinated me. So that's the one that sticks in my mind. And my favourite character was Jo. And as you know, there is a Jo in the Kate Daniels series. So maybe there was a bit of a crossover there.
"Glad to find you so merry, my girls," said a cheery voice at the door. And actors and audience turned to welcome a tall, motherly lady with a can-I-help-you look about her, which was truly delightful. She was not elegantly dressed, but a noble-looking woman, and the girls thought the grey cloak and unfashionable bonnet covered the most splendid mother in the world. "Well, dearies, how have you got on today? There was so much to do getting the boxes ready to go tomorrow that I didn't come home to dinner. Has anyone called, Beth? How's your cold, Meg? Jo, you look tired to death. Come and kiss me, baby." While making these maternal inquiries, Mrs. March got her wet things off, her warm slippers on, and sitting down in the easy chair, drew Amy to her lap, preparing to enjoy the happiest hour of her busy day. The girls flew about, trying to make things comfortable, each in her own way. Meg arranged the tea table. Jo brought wood and set chairs, dropping and overturning and clattering everything she touched. Beth trotted to and fro between parlour and kitchen, quiet and busy, while Amy gave directions to everyone as she sat with her hands folded. As they gathered about the table, Mrs. March said with a particularly happy face, "I've got a treat for you after supper." A quick, bright smile went round like a streak of sunshine. Beth clapped her hands, regardless of the biscuit she held, and Jo tossed up her napkin, crying, A letter, a letter. 3 cheers for Father. Yes, a nice long letter. He is well, and thinks he shall get through the cold season better than we feared. He sends all sorts of loving wishes for Christmas, and an especial message to you girls, said Mrs. March, patting her pocket as if she had got a treasure there.
Little Women by Louisa May Alcott is available from RNIB Talking Books in both audio and braille. The audio version is read by Gretel Davis. And is there a book on a rainy day you would happily curl up and reread?
Well, that's an odd one. I think Anything at all by Michael Connelly. I started reading him with his debut, The Black Echo. And I absolutely adore his writing. I still have. He's an author that I think has never, ever failed to wow his audience. He maintains a really high level. And to me, there is no one better. I was asked during lockdown if I would interview Michael online. I mean, I'm a real fan. It was real fangirl moment, I was thinking. I have met him. But very briefly, but we spent a good 45 minutes talking about his work, and it was fantastic.
Harry Bosch could hear the helicopter up there, somewhere above the darkness, circling up in the light. Why didn't it land? Why didn't it bring help? Harry was moving through a smoky, dark tunnel, and his batteries were dying. The beam of the flashlight grew weaker every yard he covered. He needed help. He needed to move faster. He needed to reach the end of the tunnel before the light was gone and he was alone in the black. He heard the chopper make one more pass. Why didn't it land? Where was the help he needed? When the drone of the blades fluttered away again, he felt the terror build, and he moved faster, crawling on scraped and bloody knees, one hand holding the dim light up, the other pawing the ground to keep his balance. He did not look back, for he knew the enemy was behind him in the black mist. Unseen, but there, and closing in. When the phone rang in the kitchen, Bosch immediately woke. He counted the rings, wondering if he had missed the first one or two, wondering if he had left the answering machine on. He hadn't. The call was not picked up, and the ringing didn't stop until the required 8 rounds. He absent-mindedly wondered where that tradition had come from. Why not 6 rings? Why not 10? He rubbed his eyes and looked around. He was slumped in the living room chair again, the soft recliner that was the centerpiece of his meager furnishings. He thought of it as his watch chair. This was a misnomer, however, because he slept in the chair often, even when he wasn't on call. Morning light cut through the crack in the curtains and slashed its mark across the bleached pine floor. He watched particles of dust floating lazily in the light near the sliding glass door. The lamp on the table next to him was on, and the TV against the wall, its sound very low, was broadcasting a Sunday morning Jesus show. On the table next to the chair were the companions of insomnia, playing cards, magazines, and paperback mystery novels, these only lightly thumbed and then discarded. There was a crumpled pack of cigarettes on the table and 3 empty beer bottles, assorted brands that had once been members of 6 packs of their own tribe. Bosch was fully dressed, right down to a rumpled tie held to his white shirt by a silver 187 tie tack. He reached his hand down to his belt and then around to the area below his kidney. He waited. When the electronic pager sounded, he cut the annoying chirp off in a second. He pulled the device off his belt and looked at the number. He wasn't surprised. He pushed himself out of the chair, stretched, and popped the joints of his neck and back. He walked to the kitchen where the phone was on the counter. He wrote, Sunday, 8:53 a.m., in a notebook he took from his jacket pocket before dialing. After 2 rings, a voice said,
Los Angeles Police Department, Hollywood Division, this is Officer Pelch. How can I help you?
Bosch said, Somebody could die in the time it took to get all that out. Let me talk to the watch sergeant.
Bosch found a fresh pack of cigarettes in a kitchen cabinet and got his first smoke of the day going. He rinsed dust out of a glass and filled it with tap water, then took 2 aspirins out of a plastic bottle that was also in the cabinet. He was swallowing the second when a sergeant named Crowley finally picked up.
What, did I catch you in church? I rang your house, no answer.
Crowley, what have you got for me?
Well, I know we had you out last night on that TV thing, but you're still catching, you and your partner, all weekend. So that means you got the DB up at Lake Hollywood, in a pipe up there. It's on the access road to the Mulholland Dam, you know it?
I know the place. What else?
Patrol's out, ME, Sid notified. My people don't know what they got except the DB. Stiff's about 30 feet into this pipe there. They don't want to go all the way in, mess up a possible crime scene, you know? I had him page your partner, but he hasn't called in. No answer at his phone either. I thought maybe the two of you was together or something. Then I thought, nah, he ain't your style, and you ain't his.
The Black Echo by Michael Connolly is available from RNIB Talking Books, as narrated by Dick Hill. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently you'd like to recommend.
I have read a book that hasn't yet hit the shelves. It's called All the Colours of the Dark by Chris Whitaker. It is a very long book. It is 600 plus pages long, and I devoured it. It will stay with me for a very, very long time. And I can honestly tell you that I have not read a book like it. It's a story that spans, I think, about 29 years. And it's completely fascinating. If anyone starts to listen to this, they need to make sure that they've got plenty of snacks and drinks and what have you, because they will not want to stop. Although you can get up and, you know, move around while you listen to audiobooks, which is lovely, isn't it? So I took it everywhere. I wherever I went, I was straight into the book as soon as I sat down, and really didn't want to put this one down at all.
All the Colours of the Dark will be released on the 25th of June 2024, and Orion Ducey, an audiobook, will be available on the day of release. And Mari Hanna, once again, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, there are over 350 episodes in our podcast feed. Just type Read On, RNIB, into your favourite podcast app.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.